People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. When it opened in 1921, the Weyburn Mental Hospital was hailed as the last and largest asylum in the British Commonwealth. Erica Dick writes that it was a symbol of both progress and a bygone era. That the asylum in southeastern Saskatchewan embodied a set of contradictions from the outset. Dick is a Canada Research Chair in the History of Health and Social Justice. Much of her work has centered on the now-demolished mental hospital in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. From boosterism and an idealized image of the asylum in early press, to scandal and reports of overcrowding and mistreatment, to attempted innovations in psychedelic-assisted therapy, to eventual deinstitutionalization, and a shift towards a community care model that never quite materialized as hoped. Today on the program, an outline of the history of the Weyburn Mental Hospital.
My name is Erica Dick. I'm a professor of history and Canada Research Chair at the University of Saskatchewan.
And I'm wondering if you could take me to Weyburn, Saskatchewan in 1921 and tell me what is the big news in the community?
1921 in this southeastern corner of the province of Saskatchewan was exciting times for the place of Weyburn, which was opening one of the largest mental hospitals. People in the newspapers at the time claimed that it was the largest mental hospital in the British Commonwealth. I'm not sure that was true, but certainly for the boosters around town, they were very excited about the possibility that this would be not only a huge facility, but was also the largest employer and kind of was set aside at the edge of town as its own sort of mental health campus. It was promising to be something quite novel and new. And by the time it opened its doors, this kind of gothic looking building was really more a relic of the past. It still had the sort of remnants of a 19th century asylum style care for people with mental disorders.
So that maybe sets the tone for the conversation we're going to have in Saskatchewan. This big asylum or psychiatric hospital opens up in 1921. And you're suggesting that even at the time, that was already sort of passé. Could you tell me more about that idea?
Yeah, you know, I think that for many people in that region, it seemed really bright and shiny and new, and it was all very exciting to have this, you know, purpose-built facility right, you know, in this town. It was, like I said, it was going to be a huge economic driver. But those kinds of modern elements applied more to staff and boosters and, you know, town council people than it did for the people who, primarily the people who were living in it. Now, people living in it were included staff as well as patients. But over the next 25 years, it ballooned in terms of its patient population, and it soon, you know, was like many of the kinds of, you know, Hollywood depictions of asylums that you see. It was grossly overcrowded. There were a little over 4,000 patients in it, and there were about 2,000 beds. So you can imagine the kind of, you know, overcrowding that existed. Wards were kind of decrepit already. People were being siphoned into spaces according to need, not according to diagnosis or according to care protocols. So it really kind of impoverished any of those early ideas that this might be some kind of modern facility. And over time, I think people expect or described it more as a warehouse for people who were considered unwanted, as opposed to a treatment facility that was going to help someone perhaps rehabilitate or perhaps recover from something and then re-enter society in a more healthy way, or so goes the logic.
Well, could you take me through a little bit more detail about what actually happened here in the first decades of its existence? From your writing on the subject, a few details that stood out to me were, number one, that the staffing seemed to be done along the lines of political patronage rather than merit. Number two, initially, people who were put in the institution, their estate had to cover the cost of housing them there. And number three, a detail that was particularly striking was that people who died while they were in the institution, they didn't get to be buried in the the same cemetery in the same way as people who just lived in Weyburn. But maybe what, if we're talking, it's a mental health facility, what are people going there for?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because what we found was that there were certain policies in play. You know, the idea, according to the policy, was that people were going to be treated close to home. So Weyburn created a catchment area for essentially the southern part of the province, sort of in the southeast part of the rectangle province. And there was another facility at North Battleford, which catered to essentially the northern and northwestern part. But what we found really quickly is in going through patient records that the policies didn't line up with the practice. And so patients were actually coming from a whole variety of places, including, you know, outside of the province, if they had some family connection to Saskatchewan. But families were actually prohibited from visiting their loved ones at these facilities for at least the first 2 years of treatment. And the argument was that this was going to disturb or disrupt any kind of therapeutic progress that might be made. Families were also considered sometimes the very site of dysfunction that led someone to either voluntarily commit themselves to a facility like these mental hospitals. But more often, what we found was that patients were brought in, or people were brought in and subsequently turned into patients by police officers, by magistrates, by some kind of transgression of a law or a custom. Now, it may have been a custom, like I remember a case where, you know, a man was seen riding his horse naked in a field. And so neighbors called him. Now, there's no law against riding your horse naked. So he didn't actually transgress a law, but it nonetheless offended his neighbors, or they were concerned for him. And we can determine whether it was offensive or concern. I don't know, because we can only infer. But nonetheless, this man was brought in to the asylum. We also know that in this period, in the early few decades of Saskatchewan's history as a province, it becomes a province in 1905. You start to get laws and things in place. And there's a massive wave or several waves of immigration. So you also have a number of people who are not speaking English who are also caught up in this system. And this is maybe my cynicism coming through, but for some people who were described as having disorganized speech, or, you know, were speaking nonsense is one of the phrases that we see sometimes. It turns out a number of people, you can tell sometimes from their surnames, but also from the way that neighbors then report on behavior, that there may have also been some disturbances in how people perceived other cultures, or we might just say straight up racism and different kinds of prejudice and discrimination that are pretty, you know, sort of run of the mill kinds that we see also fitting into that. It doesn't explain every case, but certainly you see elements where it's difficult to convince yourself in a retrospective analysis that discrimination is not at play. One of the areas we didn't see that so much, I say we because there was a whole team of us working on this. And I can say more about that if you like. But one of the areas that we thought we would see more of were cases of Indigenous patients. And I say Indigenous, primarily First Nations, maybe Métis, but we didn't see a preponderance of patients fitting into those categories. And by categories, again, here I'm going to say based on the patient records. So with the charge nurse, or usually it was a charge nurse or someone in admissions would have written in a chart. There's no standardization there. So some people were described in fairly pejorative terms, something like half-breed, for example, which perhaps we could say maybe that's Métis, but it's difficult for us as historians to accurately go back and say with confidence that those categories are true. Nonetheless, it seemed that those patients, if they came from what we'll say an Indigenous background, were more often rejected as patients. And we think not because there was a sense that they were not in need of care, but because they couldn't pay, or because the state was responsible for the patient, for First Nations health. And so the province, which paid for the mental hospital, didn't want to pay for the upkeep of people who they felt they'd have a bad debt. And this comes to your question about patients' estates being used to cover their costs as well. This was a very expensive business of bringing people into the hospital. And so not only did families and estates come into play in terms of the financing of the institution, but early on from the beginning, and certainly this ratcheted up over time, patients were often required to work for the institution without pay. And this was considered ethical or moral. It was not only justified as a way to train people in, say, farming or in laundry or in cooking, these were supposed to be transferable skills, but it was also a way to keep the costs of running the institution at a minimum. And you can see where there's different kinds of incentives there that maybe didn't favor humane care.
So it's fair to say there we're talking about this asylum in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, things that were happening in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. As we go through, you suggest that the government in Saskatchewan changes in the 1940s and in the 1950s. It almost becomes this kind of incubator for new and interesting ideas in healthcare. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so in 1944, things changed in Saskatchewan, particularly because the province elected Tommy Douglas, who comes in as the first kind of state-level socialist government in North America. And Douglas, you know, many people may already know this, but Douglas comes in promising to reform healthcare and, you know, over time, over the next, you know, four terms, introduces the blueprint for Canada's Medicare. So this publicly funded healthcare system. Douglas was also very specifically concerned about the mental hospital for at least two reasons. One, because it was his home constituency. And two, he had been an intern at Weyburn and he wrote his Master's of Divinity based on research that he did at this hospital. Now, his research has been used by a number of people to either, credit him or discredit him. And of course, it's political. So, it depends what you read and what you want to interpret. But Douglas was quite concerned that there were kind of generational, we might think of like degeneracy at play in these hospital settings. So particularly in areas of psychiatric health, we might think about cognitive disabilities, probably would be better language that we might use today. But he was talking about people with low IQs. And he did this comparison of people who chose poorly. So people who he described as being immoral, they knew the difference between right and wrong, but they chose to behave, you know, to transgress the law. And for this, he used prostitutes as an example of people who may have known better, but this was the choice they made. We can problematize that if you like, but anyway, for the sake of argument, that is part of what his master's thesis looked at in a school of divinity. And then the second piece was looking at patients for whom he felt, and he takes a more sympathetic view in that, for whom he felt maybe didn't appreciate the distinction between right and wrong in a moralistic context. And remembering this is a Master's of Divinity, what may be no surprise is at the end of the dissertation, he suggests that the way forward is to invest in religion. Of course, religion is a way to sort of soften these edges and help all people and break the cycle of poverty that comes from some of these immoral and amoral choices. Anyways, this kind of interesting study by a young Tommy Douglas before he's elected, and it gets a lot of play. And a number of people have seized upon this as a way to both vilify him or hold him up as someone who's trying to do better as a reformer within this healthcare setting. And Douglas, by 1944, so a decade after he wrote that master's thesis, he's really championing the need to bring humanity and healthcare together, not only in a financial sense, so breaking that cycle that I described before of like requiring patients to pay their own way for their upkeep as they receive healthcare provisions, breaking that by providing stable state funding, but also humanizing this context. So instead of this like grossly overcrowded place, like what if we tried to find ways of humanizing this and what does it mean to do that? So part of what he did is he invested heavily. The state, you know, more so than other jurisdictions, created a stable supply of grants to bring in professionals who were willing to think outside the box. And, you know, we're talking about a trapezoidal province here. So you could think, you know, they're both drawing internationally, but also to think outside of the mainstream ways of dealing with psychiatry, which is often just to house people, to provide accommodations in these hospital settings, but they aren't true. They're not places of independence. and many people are suggesting that these are essentially warehousing people, as I said before. So Douglas is suggesting that, you know, something different has to be done. And he's very personally committed to reforming Weyburn, or the Weyburn facility. And he draws in a few people. Some come for only a few months and some stay for decades and or longer. And one of the things that they start to do is, under the directorship of Humphrey Osmond, he's a British trained psychiatrist. He comes to Saskatchewan in 1951. And he says, you know, people with perceptual disorders, primarily schizophrenia and psychotic disorders, you know, they're very difficult to communicate with, in the sense that psychiatry is moving in the direction of talk therapies. You know, you need to talk about your problems. You know, we might think about Freud in this moment and the idea that you're supposed to talk about your mother, maybe your father, but primarily your mother, and, you know, uncover the problems that are leading to your behavioral dysfunction, according to this logic. And Osmond's like, yeah, but you can't really do that necessarily with someone who feels that they are living in an alternate state of reality, or whose touch points to reality are not the same as ours. So you can't create this common ground. You can't create a therapeutic relationship. For him, the way to resolve this intractable problem is for psychiatrists and social workers and nurses and maybe some politicians to take a psychoactive substance that alters their sense of reality. And so for Osmond, taking LSD, which is, you know, a synthetic of an ergot product, or taking mescaline, which grows naturally, is an alkaloid in the peyote cactus, is a way for staff to better empathize with people living in these conditions with these perceptual disorders.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Erica Dick. She's a professor of history at the University of Saskatchewan. She's also a Canada Research Chair in the History of Health and Social Justice. Much of her work has focused on the history of the Weyburn Mental Hospital in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. The hospital opened in 1921. The building was demolished in 2009. Dick has written multiple books touching on the history of the institution. Two that we're focusing on today are Managing Madness, which was co-authored by Alex Dayton, and Psychedelic Psychiatry, LSD on the Canadian Prairies. And in your writing, you suggest that for a period of around a decade, there are a lot of trials involving LSD where, you know, even the architect is taking LSD and walking around the asylum and trying to get a perspective on how the built environment maybe shapes your experience of what it's like to be in an institution. You suggested that they try using LSD as a way to help people with alcohol addiction and see some promising results. Can you just take me through some of the work that gets done during this period?
Yeah, I say, you know, for the first couple of years, they're focused on kind of training staff to appreciate. And again, this is, I really think of it as a sort of chemically inspired empathy. You know, there's this sense that patients are, you know, other, and staff are sort of mainstream. But Osmond is really keen to sort of break down those boundaries. Like, we're all kind of the same. We just communicate differently. We maybe perceive the world differently. And we need to appreciate how, you know, this kind of diversity of perception. So at first, he's focused on staff, but quickly, they start to recognize that, you know, some of the things that they themselves experience under the influence of LSD, for example, sounds a little bit like some of the things their patients have said to them. And so they do a couple of different things. One is they work with a group of people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia, not to give them LSD, but to compare, say you're a physician or a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So you take LSD and have your experience, and then you compare your sort of chemically inspired experience with a sort of organically produced manic episode or a psychotic episode, to try to understand, are we even close here? You know, are we getting close to this? And they quickly recognize that there are some fairly significant distinctions. Typically, it's auditory delusions or hearing voices that are more prominent within some of the psychotic disorders. And with the psychoactive substances, they're hallucinogenics, if you will, it's hallucinations or visual hallucinations. So seeing things that are not perceived by others. So that was one distinction, but it wasn't enough to stop the research. In fact, it was something that said, you know, but it fundamentally changed my sense of myself, my boundaries, my edges, you know, where my body is relative to my thoughts, that they wanted to proceed. And they started working with alcoholics, because this is another area that they felt that, you know, some of this sounded a little bit like what alcoholics describe at the point of, you know, hitting rock bottom, or when they're having, you know, severe delirium tremens, you're having these kind of withdrawal symptoms where they can sometimes hallucinate as well. And I'm using the language of the time, forgive me, they wouldn't say alcoholics today, substance use disorder, but nonetheless, at the time they were looking at men, almost exclusively men with problem drinking. Now you can think of, you know, returning war vets, you can think of people coming back from the Second World War, a whole variety of examples there. Nonetheless, the reason that these folks came through the front doors of the hospital was because of their problem drinking. It turns out that under the experience of LSD or mescaline, and often these are fairly large doses, sometimes there are other underlying things. Maybe there was anxiety, maybe there was some depression, maybe there were other things, but the reason that got them through the front door was problem drinking. In those moments, what they found was that these, again, almost exclusively men had profound experiences. And some research units in Swift Current and in Prince Albert and Regina, so nearby, were describing, you know, up to 80% recovery rates after 2 years of follow-up with people treated with a single dose or sometimes two doses, but not daily dose psychedelics. And part of that, I was fortunate enough to be able to interview a few of the men who were treated in this way. I did that in the early 2000s, so they were in their 80s, most of them. And what they described to me, which I didn't necessarily find in the records, was that this was, A, sometimes the first time they felt someone was actually trying to help them, not just put them in jail or put them in an institution that they felt was jail-like. And two, that it was a time that they felt extremely vulnerable and opened up in ways that they felt was not part of how they were expected to behave in other circumstances. So think military circumstances, they had to be brave and macho. Think playing hockey or, you know, going to work, you know, various things where they had to kind of keep it together. And in this moment, and subsequently, in each of the interviews that I conducted with these men, albeit a handful of them, each of them wept as they talked to me. And they did so openly, and there was with an air of dignity to the way that they were able to talk about their emotions in ways that they felt was not acceptable in other spaces. That was, for them, part of what led to this breakthrough. Now, some of them also felt that this was an extremely spiritual moment. And this is borne out in the patient records especially, not just the conversations I had, but the patient records describe people, you know, feeling that they were visited by God, or feeling that they could see their mother like an angel. And it was a profoundly spiritual moment for them as they recognized their own humanity, as well as the pain that they had caused to other humans in their lives. And I'm kind of ventriloquizing from some of the statements that I've seen, and forgive me for the you know, borrowing their language. But these really, really profound statements that were highly individualized, but also so very, very personal, but were really profound. And I think part of what happened was you take this sort of beautiful descriptions of people seeing themselves and recognizing their own humanity, these very sort of healing and heroic stories, and then you try to plug it back into a medical box and it didn't fit. So it wasn't a neat checkbox, you know, healed or unhealed or is a better person or, you know, meet some kind of threshold for recovery. Although sobriety became that threshold over time. But it was really, I think some of the researchers who were doing this work were kind of, they were toying with a variety of boundaries. Some of them were ethical. Is it okay to take a psychedelic before you give it to your patient? I don't even mean it the same day, but to have insight. I mean, some people would say absolutely not. And these guys would say, well, I think it's unethical not to try to empathize with my patients before I treat them. And so you can see these kind of ethical dimensions creeping into this context. And that, of course, will become even more controversial as time goes on.
So that is one thing that is happening in Weyburn in the 1950s. Where does it go? What happens to it?
You know, a few different things happened. You mentioned the architect. I feel I should at least acknowledge him quickly. Kiyoshi Izumi is a fascinating character in this story. He's a Japanese Canadian who left from BC to avoid being interned, ends up in Saskatchewan, and over time is drawn into this research environment as one who is very committed to reforming the way that people experience their institutional environments in ways, again, that kind of align with this idea of humanizing space, or space that would allow you to feel more autonomous. So less like a jail, more like a home, we might think. And to do that, he also takes LSD and then walks around the asylum or the Weber Mental Hospital in an effort to try to understand, like, you know, how do we perceive space when we are experiencing an altered sense of reality? So things like tiles on floors become really important to him. Like, some of them look like holes and whatnot. This is really promising. This gets the attention of the American Psychiatric Association. They describe some of his designs and suggestions as, you know, innovative and world-changing. He gets awards. And you'd think that, you know, things are on the ascendancy, but I'm sure your listeners are aware that, you know, psychedelics did not become the Prozac of the 1960s. It went in a very different direction. And I think a couple of different things happened. One was that some of these looming questions about ethics and finances and healthcare economics were kind of bubbling up in their own way and reached a bit of a collision point. In part, I think, because at the same time that some psychiatrists were getting excited about a psychedelic psychiatry, and the word psychedelic comes from exactly this space, it's Humphrey Osmond who promotes the term in 1956 in Saskatchewan from his home in Weyburn, you know, so there's a real anchor point there. As psychedelic psychiatry is sort of gathering allies and supporters, and, you know, it's spreading across the world in some ways, or at least the Anglo, beyond the Anglo world. At the same time, daily dose pharmaceuticals are also coming in and I think sort of promising to reform psychiatry in really profound ways. So we think of our first generation of antipsychotic medications and antidepressants. This is just before SSRIs come into play, but they're kind of an earlier generation to the SSRIs. These daily dose symptom management pharmaceuticals that are a huge multi-billion, maybe trillion, I don't know, industry today, but they're in their infancy at the same time as LSD. And one of the big differences, I think, between these two approaches is how to measure their efficacy, how to do a risk profile. And we see the emergence, really the acceptance of the randomized controlled trial as the gold standard for determining safety and efficacy. Now, the randomized controlled trial is great for determining certain things. We want that for our vaccines. We want that for certain medications, but psychedelics did not fit that profile. Sticking someone in a room, blindfolding them, leaving them, you know, on their own to see the pharmacological effects of a psychedelic ended up producing very negative effects, even unethical effects. But the counter argument to that by a number of peer researchers was that if you aren't measuring the pharmacological effects, what are you measuring? You know, could this be a placebo? Could LSD taken in another environment be, you know, is it the LSD or is it the environment? Is it the fact that you're finally talking to these guys who've been dragged out of the drunk tank and no one's ever paid attention to them and you're being nice to them? And, you know, pretty nurses, that's a quote from one of the articles, actually, pretty nurses are helping them and now they feel better. But it's not actually the LSD, it's the environment. Well, we can't measure that in the same way. So it gets kind of pushed to the side. And a number of researchers sort of step away from the psychedelic work because it's really messy. It's really hard to sort of figure out what's the mode of action here. So on the one hand, you've got psychopharmaceuticals in the era of ascendancy, but you've also got a recreational appeal of psychedelics that far exceeds what's happening with the other pharmaceuticals at the time. So this is not OxyContin yet. This is not, you know, the sort of pharmaceutical created substances that are drawing in a recreational market with chlorpromazine or largactyl, thorazine, these kinds of antipsychotics. Psychedelics have a very different appeal, though. Not only are they appealing to musicians and artists and counterculture figures and maybe some anti-war protesters, particularly in the United States, we think of that kind of countercultural image, but they also have a long tradition of being used in Indigenous ceremonies And these things don't fit neatly into the medical model. So you start seeing a kind of splintering, I think, of people who are interested in promoting psychedelics, but they don't fit neatly into mainstream science, and they don't fit neatly into sort of mainstream culture, such that you get political officials who are keen to prohibit indigenous ceremonies, counterculture behavior, going to Grateful Dead concerts and maybe taking your clothes off, like, you know, that kind of outrageous behavior. I'm being facetious a little bit here. Your listeners may enjoy the Grateful Dead, and this is no shade on them. I just mean, using these things in a recreational context is not considered, ethical, moral, upstanding behavior. And there's all sorts of prohibitions that are looming in this decade. Researchers are having a harder and harder time maintaining their research credibility as their recreational draw of psychedelics really kind of amplifies. And we see that ricocheting through newspapers and television now, and fashions, music, you know, it's kind of overtaking things in this psychedelic aesthetic. By the 1970s, a number of jurisdictions, beginning in the United States, but and then quickly there's a domino effect elsewhere, prohibit the use of psychedelics in medical contexts. In fact, they are scheduled in a way that prohibits their continued research, claims that they are addictive and of no medicinal value. Now, those things today are being questioned, but for a number of decades, their psychedelic research is kind of ground to a halt, or trickled to a halt in some jurisdictions. And it kind of goes underground. But people like Osmond and the folks from Weyburn kind of lost the momentum. And that social, political, and medical experiment kind of frays at the edges as people are dispersed in different places, and that the kind of heart of that psychedelic project kind of flows outside those borders and no longer maintains that momentum.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. I'm speaking with University of Saskatchewan professor Erica Dick. We're talking about the history of the Weyburn Mental Hospital in southeastern Saskatchewan. Those interested in a deeper dive on the topic can check out some of Dick's books, including Psychedelic Psychiatry and Managing Madness. There's also a 2004 documentary called Weyburn, An Archaeology of Madness. As of recording, that film can be tracked down in full on YouTube. So, psychedelic psychiatry kind of has this moment at Weyburn in the 1950s. It kind of peters out. Deinstitutionalization is something we hear a lot of people talk about as kind of a broader trend, and my understanding is that Weyburn, it hit particularly hard and fast. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, deinstitutionalization, fascinating. So this is kind of like a transnational movement to, you know, close these outdated, outmoded psychiatric hospitals and embrace care in the community. And of course, the idea is that people are going to live better, fuller, more autonomous lives in the community, perhaps with their families and their loved ones. And this is going to be a wonderful transformation of psychiatric care. And what part of what we did in Managing Madness was we tried to create sort of a, like, imagine a psychiatric team. That's not even the right, like a community care team, I should say more broadly, to write the book, because, you know, I've got my historian's perspective and, you know, I bring certain skills to it, but I have many gaps in my abilities as well. So part of that team included former superintendent Hugh Lefebvre, a former civil servant and psychologist John Elias. We had a patient, Tracy Mitchell. Anyway, there are other authors involved. Hugh Lefebvre was the superintendent who started in 1963. And he told us, as we worked on the book together, he said, my singular goal in coming into that position was to close that hospital. He felt that it was a gross example of the mistreatment of people to have people sort of institutionalized in this way, in this overcrowded, sometimes, you know, often chronically underfunded. You know, they weren't part of the community, as evidenced by their not being allowed to be buried in the same cemetery. Like, all of these things he felt were grossly dehumanizing. They were a human rights abuse. We need to close the hospital. One of the other people, John Elias, one of his jobs was to drive into nearby communities and find housing and employment for people. And though these two continue, they continued to have a very respectful relationship. They wanted to work on the book together, but they had different views on how this worked. And I think that's something that we really wanted to capture in the book as we talked about deinstitutionalization. The idea the philosophy behind it was great. But one of the great disappointments by people like Hugh and John was that the community was not ready to receive the, in this case, 4,000 patients who were being deinstitutionalized. It wasn't overnight. But even at that, many families were quite reluctant to bring in someone that they felt either estranged from or that they didn't know how to care for. The governments often did not, and this is across jurisdictions, did not want to provide a sort of scattered set of funding that would create that kind of stable infrastructure. And what patients told us in our conversations was that, you know, some of them had never used money before. They'd used tokens in their institutions, but there was no need for cash. They didn't know how to use money. They didn't know how to take buses. Some of them had low literacy rates because that wasn't a priority in the institution. And some people were leaving at the age of, you know, 50, 60 years old. And so it was a very difficult transition that was not supported, according to the research that we did, that both patients, staff, and community sort of receivers or receptacles didn't feel it was adequately supported. And it created a challenge when it came to kind of finding, pointing fingers or identifying where the problems were, because now it was very scattered, both in terms of communities, but also in terms of jurisdictional lines. So blame the finance minister, blame the health minister, you know, all of these things were kind of disaggregated across multiple jurisdictions, including federal, municipal, you know, local governments and whatnot. So it became harder and harder to challenge the so-called psychiatric system or mental health system because it was sort of disaggregated.
Well, there's a narrative, I feel, as a journalist sometimes reporting on this beat, that almost anyone you talk to will talk about this idea of deinstitutionalization, how North American society moved away from these big asylums to this model of care in the community. And there seems to be consensus that in some way, shape, or form, that care in the community never really materialized, either because it wasn't adequately funded or for some other reason. So there's kind of consensus on that. And then from there, people almost sort of use that to make whatever point they want to make about mental health care in some way, shape, or form. How accurate is that narrative? Or what do you think, as someone who has spent decades researching in this field, you think it's important to contextualize that idea with?
I think it is. I agree. I think there is consensus in the field that it was a failure. What we hope to say by the end of the book was that it was a failure, but we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater entirely. That of course it's more complex. I mean, otherwise I'd be out of a job if I didn't say that, you know, that is my whole purpose. You know, everything's more complicated. But there were elements of the hospital system that actually weren't retained when people moved into these spaces that, you know, I don't think anyone was like, yes, let's take away autonomy and let's live in these conditions, but a one-stop shopping, even jurisdictionally, like, should I go to an EI office or do I need to get social services or how do I get housing? And what about, you know, what kind of employment steps can I take? There now, you know, you have to go. Just, one woman explained to me, you know, like how many different bus routes do I need to take to accommodate some of the things that we took for granted living in the institution? And it wasn't that the institution was great or that this is better, but, you know, this transition was so significant. And there wasn't a sort of gentle introduction of these things or some way to bring stuff together. The infrastructure fundamentally changed. But I think along with that, and I'm sure you've encountered this lots in your work, there's all sorts of politicizing of what does it mean to be autonomous? And well, I think that it's really complicated. I think there's a diversity of experiences in the community that, you know, not everyone wants to be forced to have to live in this kind of accommodation, and yet some people appreciate it. And I think that's a hard lesson to learn when we think about deinstitutionalization. It's not like all patients walk out the door and they have the same profile and they have the same needs. They're diverse. It's a diverse population of individuals with diverse needs, some of which are health related, many of which are economic related. And it's really hard, I think, to imagine a universal system that's going to catch everyone where they're at, meet them where they're at, and provide those needs. And it's going to require, I think, you know, some uncomfortable rolling up sleeves and finding, matching those kind of community services to communities, not one that's designed in Nanaimo that will work in Saskatoon, but probably Nanaimo has its own, you know, contours of needs that, and I think that was a hard lesson to learn. And one last piece on this, I'll say that Hugh Lefebvre, I think, was quite frustrated. Well, no, he was absolutely very frustrated with the way things worked. He was like, yay, you know, like this didn't quite pan out the way he had envisioned. And after that, after sort of downsizing the hospital, he became a fierce and tireless advocate for universal basic income, which he felt was imperative for the success of deinstitutionalization. And he felt this is going to help. It's going to help health. It's going to help, you know, all of these different things. If we could replace what we paid for hospitals and put that into a basic income plan, that would be a solution. And many people disagree with him, of course. But he wrote quite passionately about that being a missing piece of it that he felt very frustrated about.
Well, Erica Dick, there's so much more to dive into on this, but I need to let you go. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, and you know, thanks for indulging me with all these great questions.
Erica Dick is a professor of history at the University of Saskatchewan and a Canada Research Chair in the history of health and social justice.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A staff lawyer with Pivot Legal Society says people are encouraged to use drugs at supervised consumption sites, but lack sufficient legal protections on their way to those sites. Caitlin Shane says this situation is illustrative of mixed messages that society is sending to people who use drugs. I spoke with her in Nanaimo earlier this month.
My name is Caitlin Shane. I'm a staff lawyer of Pivot Legal Society, which is a legal organization based in the downtown east side of Vancouver.
And can you tell me, what does your work with Pivot Legal Society comprise of?
So Pivot is a human rights legal organization, and we are comprised of social workers, lawyers, advocates, activists, and we work on several core issues. My campaign specifically is drug policy. So as a lawyer, I advocate for decriminalization of drug possession and the legal regulation of all drugs. But we also have campaigners working on sex workers' rights, on the rights of unhoused and precariously housed people, and on people who experience police violence. So we do a lot of things, among them legal actions, but also public legal education and government advocacy.
Can you tell me how you came into doing the work that you're doing and why it's your focus?
So for many years before going to law school, I worked as a mental health worker in tent cities and supportive housing and supervised consumption sites in Vancouver and Victoria. And, you know, frontline service work is incredibly important, but also there are big structural issues that are resulting in the circumstances that people face. So things like drug prohibition and a housing crisis and government inertia to provide the services and care that people need. So that's sort of what drove me to the work. I am fortunate enough to live in a city that has an incredibly strong history, continued history of drug user activism and organizing. And so I take my direction from drug user-led groups, and I'm really proud to work directly with people who use drugs.
So as a lawyer working on drug policy, what exactly are you doing?
So it looks very different from day to day. Pivot believes in something called a diversity of tactics, which means that no single tactic is superior and that all tactics are necessary in addressing state violence and ensuring the liberation of all people. So some days I'll be in court, other days I might be in a government boardroom doing advocacy towards state actors. Sometimes I'll be before city council. Other times I'll be at a drug user-led group doing public legal education to make sure people know their rights. I also do media and direct action. And so it's a lot of things because I think all things are necessary to address the war on drugs.
When you say address the war on drugs, could you dive into a little bit more detail about what you mean in that framing?
Sure. So in Canada, and you know, this is a policy that extends federally, provincially, municipally, we criminalize every activity related to substances, controlled substances, and we highly stigmatize people who use drugs. We have yet to legally regulate the drug supply. That's why we have such a toxic drug supply that's unpredictable, because so long as there is demand for drugs, which there always has been, always will be, for very good reasons, so long as there's demand, supply will always meet that demand. And if government refuses to meet the demand in a controlled and regulated way, then that demand is met through the illicit drug market, which of course is profit motivated and entirely saturated with unpredictable drugs. So what we advocate for is for the legal regulation of all drugs to allow for a level of control and quality standard for substances, and also to assist in reducing the stigma and criminalization of people who use drugs.
When we're talking about advocating for changes to drug policy or approaching a system of regulation of drugs as opposed to what we have now, how do you try and get the message across to people who aren't already on board with that? Or what do you think is even the role of doing that?
That's a really good question, and a question that I spend a lot of time thinking about. I don't think there's any single way to change hearts or minds or convince people to do the right thing. So again, it's a diversity of tactics. There are certain audiences that I might be more sort of gentle with and trying to appeal to certain emotions, and there are other audiences, particularly people in power, governments, etc., who are creating these laws and doubling down on them, that I might take a more aggressive approach, or you know, a more straightforward approach. So I don't know how to change people's minds. I think it takes all of us, and I think different people are motivated by different things. So that's why this is really a collective effort, and we all need to be advocating for the liberation of people who use drugs.
And I understand that you do a lot of work with vulnerable populations in Vancouver. You came to Nanaimo to speak to the Nanaimo Area Network of Drug Users. What kind of messages are you offering those crowds? What kinds of things are you hearing from those populations when you speak with them?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I travel throughout the province and meet with drug users all around the province. And even though there's unique differences from place to place, the patterns are the same, and it's more of it's a reminder that these patterns are structural and that power plays out very similarly, although there are differences, of course. What I try to bring to these sessions is the idea that the law and the court system are not the only way to change laws and policies, and that we need to be advocating and organizing collectively, and even just having these meetings in the first place, I think is incredibly important, because as we know, the only way that laws change ultimately are oftentimes because they were started first by people who use drugs, who put their liberties on the line to set up illegal overdose prevention sites and supervised consumption sites and convinced government that this is what had to happen.
One of the things you were talking about today was the situation with supervised consumption sites. They operate in a number of communities. They're a place where people can go, and while they're there, they're not under the expectation that they are going to be prosecuted for using the substances that one would consume at a safe supervised consumption site. But that outside of those sites, there isn't any kind of legal framework to protect people, say, like on their way to the site to use the substances. What do you think it's important for the general population to understand about that situation?
I think the fact that people are being encouraged to go to overdose prevention sites and supervised consumption sites to use drugs, while at the same time facing criminalization en route, is really illustrative of the mixed messages that we're sending to people who use drugs. We have governments of every level telling people who use drugs to use drugs safely, and yet we're saying, while you walk to a safe space, you risk criminalization. That's unacceptable, and I really do wish that, again, collectively as a society, we could push back against that and demand more from our governments.
Is that a situation you see playing out? Like, are you hearing from people that contradiction has impacted their lives in some way, shape, or form?
Absolutely. There's a reason why statistically people are dying in record numbers alone in their rooms. That's the most likely place that people are to fatally overdose, according to the coroner's data. So clearly there's hesitation among certain people to access these sites. And I would imagine that part of that is because of the risk of criminalization. I have lots of clients who, if they see officers outside of or around a supervised consumption site, they're not going to go near it. And the result of that is that people have fewer safe places to use drugs, and we contribute absolutely to the rate of fatal overdoses.
And what is your assessment of the situation with the decriminalization pilot and its subsequent end, and how it impacts that situation we were just discussing with supervised consumption sites?
Yeah, I think decriminalization, the pilot that BC implemented, had a lot of shortcomings. It was really limited, and it didn't extend full protection to people who use drugs. I advocate for full decriminalization. I don't think people should be arrested for possessing drugs for their own use. And the narrower the policy is, the more people fall through the cracks. So if government were really concerned with the health and safety of people who use drugs, they wouldn't put so many conditions on their so-called health policy. That said, it was, you know, progress and improvement. It was something that people who use drugs fought really hard to win. And so I think that's important. And the rollback was devastating, frankly. The fact that government would end this policy that was meeting government's own goals in terms of reducing police interactions between people who use drugs and increasing comfort of people to access supervised consumption sites, the fact that they were meeting those goals and then decided nonetheless to end the policy is shameful. One of the key findings that came out of that policy was that Indigenous youth felt more comfortable accessing supervised consumption sites and overdose prevention sites because they no longer feared arrest en route to these sites. Now the government has rolled back that protection, and that's a real shame because we will see the results of that in the numbers of fatal overdoses.
So if we're talking about some of those situations are kind of like a more policy level, when you're doing work with individual people, what sorts of situations are you helping them through? What kind of things are you able to do for someone right now who is in need of some legal help or advice?
So Pivot does something called strategic litigation. We're not a legal clinic in the sense that someone walks through the doors and can have immediate assistance with a legal issue. Rather, we will take stock of the types of issues that people are facing in large numbers, identify the law or policy that's at issue, and then challenge that law or policy through the court system. So it's a different kind of process than a legal clinic. It's more about challenging the overarching structures that are at play that create negative conditions for people. That said, other parts of my work involve, you know, directly organizing with people who use drugs, attending meetings, doing public legal education so that people can stand up for themselves. I'm a strong believer in drug user autonomy and liberation, and so that forms the basis of my work.
So a fair understanding for people would be that if there is a situation you feel like is particularly illustrative of here is a problem where this policy rubs up against some problem in our legal framework or against someone's charter rights, and you feel like someone's individual case is representative of that, then that's the kind of thing that Pivot Legal Society would take on in an effort almost to challenge and get change on that law?
That has been our approach, yeah. So historically, we've represented a number of tent cities or encampments, the idea being that even though we're representing this singular tent city in this particular city, the idea is that this tent city is emblematic of what we're seeing around the province and around the country. And so we would the legal issue at play would be that we would actually challenge the bylaw or law that prohibits camping in public places in the hopes of setting a precedent that then applies to everyone throughout the province.
Are there any cases you would point to that you feel like have made a particular impact in our society over the decades of Pivot's existence?
Yeah, there's been a number of cases that we've been involved in. Part of our advocacy around representing a tent city in Abbotsford resulted in a finding that the bylaw that prohibited overnight sheltering in parks in Abbotsford was unconstitutional and needed to be struck down. So that was a case, it's called Chance, and it contributed to the law across the province that says that people who don't have anywhere else to go are able to camp overnight in parks and public spaces. I was recently part of a case where I represented the Harm Reduction Nurses Association, which is a national nurse organization, to challenge BC's prohibition on public drug consumption during the decriminalization period. And we successfully obtained an injunction from the court that said, actually, this law is going to drive people into it's going to drive drug use underground, and it's going to psychologically harm and distress the nurses and service providers that won't be able to find their clients because those clients fear arrest and therefore are using drugs in the shadows.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with the public about your work on drug policy advocacy as a lawyer with Pivot Legal Society?
I think the key is always that people who use drugs know what's best for themselves and so often are kept out of rooms and decision-making processes. And so I think that if you're a lawyer or an advocate, it's your responsibility to ensure that people who use drugs are not just at the table, but have the pen in their hand and are directly involved in the creation of laws and policies that affect them.
Caitlin Shane, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Shane is a staff lawyer with Pivot Legal Society. I was speaking with her earlier this month in Nanaimo. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder, you can track down past interviews and episodes on our podcast feed. Just search People First Radio on your favorite podcast player, be it Apple, be it Spotify, or be it YouTube. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.